The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to The Commentary Track. I'm Frank Thompson, your host, rail splitter, man of the people. We have a really good one today. You know, I do this because I love movies. I'm just interested in them, like them, enjoy myself while watching movies, enjoy researching them. And I watch movies on TV. Doesn't everybody? I have a nice high-def screen, and I watch Turner Classic Movies, and the movies look just terrific, and I like my DVDs. In fact, I just got the entire series of Get a Life, the great Chris Elliott show on DVD, and I'm in hog heaven watching those. But I have a special place in my heart for the giant movies, the great big ones. I might deny this in so many other facets of my life, but in movies, size matters. But what we have coming up here in Los Angeles, starting next week and going for a couple of weeks, is something that nobody should miss. It's celebrating Cinerama's 60th anniversary by showing every surviving Cinerama film. And by that, I mean every Cinerama film, because they all survive. Some of them survived better than others. And the man I'm going to talk to in this episode of the Commentary Track is the man who's basically responsible for bringing these films back to life. He's Dave Strohmeyer. He has been in charge of restoring most of the Cinerama films and has had a hand in restoring all of the Cinerama films. A few years ago, he directed and wrote a terrific documentary called Cinerama Adventure. He developed Smilebox, which is the best way to simulate the Cinerama experience on your television screen. And Smilebox works just fine. It really is a nice thing. If your TV is big enough, and if you sit close enough, and you watch the Cinerama film in a Smilebox presentation, it really does give you the feeling of Cinerama. But nothing substitutes for seeing an actual presentation of the real Cinerama. I tell you, you see these things the way they're presented, it's on a huge curved screen. If you sit close enough, and I recommend that you do sit close up to it and not far back, because it's really an immersive experience. It's unlike anything else you'll ever experience in a movie theater. So what I'm saying is, if you live close to Los Angeles and you don't come see these things, you're just a sap. You are just a sap. I have no use for you. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see a lot of this stuff. And in the case of The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm, this has not been seen in America publicly in Cinerama in decades, maybe since original release. It has been the holy grail of Cinerama films for a lot of us who have tried to see all of these things, and it has just been impossible to see. And I am all a Twitter that it is playing at the Cinerama Dome this month. So Dave is a fascinating guy and has done wonderful work. And one of the things that he has just done, and this is just the kind of insane thing that makes me love somebody, he has made a Cinerama film called In the Picture. And it's going to be debuting. It's about a half hour long, I think. And it's going to be debuting at the Cinerama Dome as part of this Cinerama Festival. And I am pleased to say that me and my wife both appear. Shall I say, my wife and I both appear in this very, very briefly, but I am so weirdly tickled to have been even a tiny, tiny, tiny part of this huge, giant film. And to actually be in a Cinerama film is almost beyond what my film geekiness can stand. So I hope you'll see that. But more important, I hope that you will see the real Cinerama films, How the West Was Won, This is Cinerama, Cinerama Holiday, Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm. I think you can still get tickets to most of these things, and I urge you to do it. So I've probably adued enough. So without further ado, let's get to my interview with Dave Strohmeyer. See you on the other side.
my parents used to have this thing called Children's Day. You know, there was a Mother's Day and a Father's Day. We got our little union together, me and my sister, and said, well, what about Children's Day, you know? So one of the things we did was these little day trips or something. Sometimes we would go for 2 days. We're a family that couldn't afford a two-week vacation or Disneyland or anything like that. So I'm from a small town in Iowa called Keokuk, Iowa. And so we drove to St. Louis because my dad was in pilot training. He was in the Air Force and everything, but he was learning to be a commercial pilot. And he wanted to see what the local St. Louis airport looked like, which was about a three-hour drive. And that was when they built that ultra-modern-looking 1950 terminal there. And part of the thing is that I had heard that there was this thing called Cinerama that you could see in St. Louis. So my sister and I kind of are in the back seat, you know, besides are we there yet, it's like, where's that Cinerama theater, you know? And so we ended up seeing a movie called Seven Wonders of the World in 1950, probably summer of 57 is my guess, and of course, we got the cheap seats in the balcony because nobody could afford anything. But this theater was just an amazing, you know, just Arabian Nights kind of theater, you know, almost an atmospheric in a way. And we were up in the balcony. We saw this movie, and everybody loved it. And we just couldn't stop talking about it for a couple of days. And then went back to Iowa with the rest of our lives. And lo and behold, in 1964, we take another trip, this time a week-long trip to Denver, Colorado, and the Rocky Mountains, and we saw How the West Was Won. Because we drove by a theater. My dad didn't know this. I knew where it was. We drove by a theater and said, we got to stop there, and we ended up barely getting tickets for that night because it was hard getting tickets for some of these Cinerama shows. They were always sold out, pretty much, in their first, you know, 6 months of a run of a movie, you know. So between those two Cinerama experiences and then going back to your local movie theater and seeing, you know, classics and whatever and Around the World in 80 Days and whatever came down the pike in the 50s and 60s, I ended up becoming a projectionist at that same movie theater, my hometown movie theater, and at the drive-in as well. I ended up managing one of the drive-in theaters. So I'd always had this background of film and worked my way through college, film school, by being a projectionist, doing my homework at night while I'm changing reels, you know. And so then I ended up getting in the movie industry, and out here in Hollywood, my first job actually out of film school was at the mailroom of Warner Brothers, which is very unusual for someone to walk out of film school and get a job without any connections whatsoever. Yeah. And I just wrote a letter to the head of the studio and said, you know, where do I sign, you know? And he just thought this letter was so incredible that they called me up personally and said, come on out to California. So I end up at Warner Brothers. And I would go to, you know, meet with other filmmaker types and, you know, the usual suspects. And somebody at a cocktail party mentioned something about something was going to be playing at the Cinerama Dome. I don't know what it was. It was probably Apocalypse Now or something. And I said, yeah, you remember that thing called Cinerama they had years ago? And this was probably, what, 70-something, 78, 79, something like that. And a couple of people in the room did not know what Cinerama was, and a couple of the older types did. You know, so we got into this discussion about it, and, well, if it was any good, it would have lasted, and all this, you get all this stuff. And I said, well, it lasted quite a while, actually, for, you know, 3D was there just a couple of years, and it went away, and Cinerama was there for about 10 or 12 years, you know. Then nothing happened, I forgot about it, and then lo and behold, this guy in Ohio, John Harvey, set up his screening room at the new Neon, and so I thought, well, maybe there's a story in all this somewhere along the line, you know. Local projectionist revives lost format kind of, you know, Indiana Jones thing, right? So I went out there with a couple of camera crew type, a producer friend of mine and a cameraman, and we went out and shot interviews with John Harvey in his house and started realizing that the story was bigger than a guy in Ohio putting this on. Not that that wasn't an uninteresting story, it certainly was, but there was a bigger story to tell here about all these guys from the 50s. Some of them even got killed making these movies. So that's when I decided that maybe I should do some kind of a documentary about it. Of course, I was talking about a half-hour Huell Hauser kind of thing in a way, you know. It ended up being this monster movie, you know, that is now going to be on Turner Classic Movies on October 18th. You know?
Were you just aware of Cinerama because you'd heard something about it, or were you aficionado of big screen movies?
No, Cinerama was. Some people will not think this is correct, but it certainly is. Cinerama was a household word, just like Tide, just like Dove soap, just like all that stuff. It was a household word. Everyone kind of knew about it. Most people hadn't seen it, but everyone knew sort of what it was. It was big, and it was gigantic, and I wish we could see that someday was pretty much it, you know.
It was certainly a parodied word, too. A Rama turned out to be used all over the place.
I mean, Rama was used before that, but it was really got a big jump start. Everything became a Rama after that, as we tell that story in the documentary about, you know, the Autoramas and the panoramic windshields. You know, people were putting bigger windshields, called them picture windows, in your house when you would build a house in 1957. I want that big picture window, you know. So it affected a lot of things. Houses didn't have picture windows before that. That was sort of a 50s thing, you know. But, it was a household word, so everyone knew about it. Articles were written about it. You'd see something about the paper, and you just knew. We all knew when a new Cinerama movie came out, we would hear about it. So,
yeah, I lived in the wrong part of the country. I grew up in a small southern town, and I wasn't even aware of it. It didn't even, because there was no place anywhere close to where I lived. Okay. Atlanta was 3.5 hours away, and that was the closest place you could go.
Well, it's about with us. St. Louis was about 3 hours away. Maybe, you know, in those days, cars, you know, they didn't have freeways, so it probably was about a 4-hour drive. Yeah.
So the first time I saw How the West Was Won, I guess I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was re-released late 60s sometime. I can't remember exactly when I saw it, but it was a 35mm flat.
Oh, right.
I mean, it was a scope print, but of course, you know, so all the perspective was kerflooey. Nevertheless, liked it pretty well.
And it was an okay movie. When you see it in Cinerama, it's an overwhelming movie.
That's the weird thing. It's always been probably my favorite musical score, the Alfred Newman music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I've seen it in 35 scope. I had a 16 scope print. I saw it on Laserdisc, and I always thought, well, it's okay. It's, you know, it is what it is. But then when the first time I saw it in actual Cinerama at the Dome.
Oh, you were a recent.
The first time I ever saw Cinerama. I saw This is Cinerama and then How the West Was Won. And went to see it three times the first time it showed. And then saw it twice the second time it showed.
Well, you get a chance to see it two more times.
Yep. I've got tickets. And I always sit someplace different. Do you ever do that?
I never sit in the middle. I don't get the Cinerama effect where most people call the sweet spot. I'm just dulled to it. It doesn't affect me at all. I might as well be watching a TV screen. If I sit off to the edge, off to the sides, I get it.
Oh, I see.
I don't know what. It's probably something wrong with my brain, but, you know.
Well, I find that you sit at different parts of the theater, is like a different movie every time.
Yeah. And well, you're seeing it from a different angle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't say that about many films. Even big CinemaScope or 70mm films, you can't really say that about them.
Running it is a trip. Running it up in the booth I always equate it to these old submarine movies where there's a leak in one part of the submarine because of a depth charge, and then one goes off the other, and then you run over and patch the leak over there, and you adjust this and you adjust that, and then running Cinerama this morning, actually, and had a problem. So it's just constant. You know. Amazingly, it usually behaves itself when there's an audience, usually. But when there's no audience and we're testing it, everything falls apart.
Well, tell people exactly what is involved in showing it, because I don't think many people have an idea of just how complicated projecting the thing is. I mean, it's actually four projectors.
Yeah, it's four projectors. One is the sound. You know, the three are the, you know, you have to be in good sync, and you have to set the shutter ahead of time to make sure that the intermittent pull down is at a certain point. And there's a little red line you got to make sure of. There's a footage counter on each projector. That's not normal, you know. There is, of course, it's six perf. The loops have to be a little different. So if you're used to threading a projector, you got to think differently. And you have to catch yourself doing it that way. We wear tags up there, little, what do you call them, that hang around your neck, and it has a card on it for this particular show, because some Cinerama movies are slightly different than others. How the West Is Won and This Is Cinerama are two completely different sets of alignments. So, and you they never give us time between these two shows, so the alignments are done on the fly, generally. So you have to check for that. Then after you're threading up each one of your projectors, then you go check the other two. And the other guys who have threaded their projector come over to yours and check yours. So each projector is checked three, sometimes four times before it starts up. And there's always an error that can happen, such as when we ran it for the Turner Classic Movies Festival. I'm going to tell some tales out of school here. Which was a performance that we wanted to be flawless. It ended up being flawless, but it almost wasn't, because at intermission, Act One was rethreaded up again. So I have labels on all the film that you can walk by each projector with your flashlight and hold it up at a certain spot, because it's coming off of a platter down into the projector, and it says HWWW, How the West Was Won, Act One, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that's the last check after you check the threading, is you go back and make that one check. No, I got Act One. I know I did. No, we're checking it again. You have to do it that way, because you cannot have any kind of confidence. The moment you get confidence in it, that's when the things go wrong. So that's the process. Then, of course, they add the soundtrack to that between the three projectors. So there's a lot of running around with the three or four guys that are up there to check and recheck before it starts.
Do you think that had more to do with the demise of the process than the actual filmmaking?
No, all the movies were reasonably popular, with the exception of Search for Paradise, which only played about 3 or 4 months. All the movies were successful movies. How the West Was Won was the number one grossing movie of that year. This Is Cinerama was the number of its year. And Cinerama Holiday, the second one they made, was the number two box office hit of that year. So they were all in the top ten, some floating around there somewhere, you know. So they were successful. It was the dramatic, making a dramatic film in the process, was the problem that you'd get bogged down in. And if you see the Cinerama Adventure documentary, you'll see what I mean. We didn't go into that much detail, like they couldn't make their day. They couldn't, you know, as soon as you get the weather change, I mean, it's, you know, you couldn't hide stuff. Well, there's a bunch of clouds over here, but if we shoot over here with a regular CinemaScope camera, it'll look blue, and we'll get our actors, and we'll get our shot, and we'll make our day, and we'll go home happy, right? Well, at Cinerama, it's wide. You're going to see this everything you don't want to see in those five telephone poles. Yeah. And you want to pause it? So,
okay.
So, you know, with Cinerama, you had less flexibility, because you couldn't just isolate an area and shoot it or change the angle slightly. You had this gigantic thing that was covering half the sky. So, you know, you could see that storm coming, whereas in CinemaScope, you didn't have to. You could probably get the shot before the day was over, and, you know. So there were all that, the actors' problems, the recording sound was always a hassle, too, because the microphones would be in the shot. You couldn't. The lighting was a problem, because you couldn't light it a certain way, and you had to be careful every time you did a setup, because you would get a sun flare. It's so wide, you'd get a sun. The sun was, you know, another thing, because it was chasing you, you know, down it was chasing you through the day, and you had to set up your angles and plan your angles for that sun being where it is, just like we did on this recent thing we filmed, you know. So it was a lot of aggravation. And I could see, to a certain extent, having done this, directed this little Cinerama short, that everyone must have been tearing their hair out, because you could not, you had to have your list of shots that you want to get, and you had to know where to compromise and start scratching shots off the list, and what shots you really did have to have. What would be nice to have to cut to this or that, you know, you just had to totally think differently, where you wouldn't have to. So I think the filmmakers, the actors, the production people, we're probably more responsible for it going down the tubes. They've got to have something more cinematic, more easy to film.
Yeah. Well, also because of the curve of the screen, it presented problems for the way the actors even interacted with each other.
Oh, yeah. Acting is, who told me that? Russ Tamblyn told me this. He said, acting is reacting. And you can't react, because you can't see the actor you're with unless you're in the same panel with them. You know? So you can't relate to that line of dialogue he just spoke to you.
That had never hit home to me. I never really thought about it, I guess, until I was watching a 16mm scope print of How the West Was Won, and there was one scene where I guess it was George Peppard and Henry Fonda or somebody talking to each other from opposite panels,
yeah.
And you could see that they were clearly not looking at each other. I mean,
yeah.
It was because it was a flat image.
On a curved screen, it helps a little. Yeah.
And that was the first time I thought, oh yeah, because of the curve, you would have to always look somewhere else than look at the actor that you were acting with.
Well, it's not only the curve; it's the lenses are at angles.
Yeah,
So it's you're photographing it from a different perspective, and you're in a different panel, so you have to look past the other actor over his shoulder. And then it sort of looks like you're looking at him on the screen, if you do it right. We had the same problem with what we call In the Picture, which is that short we made. You know, we'd tell the actors to do it, and they would, you know, dutifully try and obey and hit their marks and everything. A few times they missed, but we never knew when they hit or missed their marks because we can't hear them act, number one. The camera's so noisy, we all have to stand by. We all have to huddle behind the camera. Mm-hmm. The only way I can see if they hit their marks is to look under the tripod to see where their feet are. And there's no video assist, so you are directing blind. And I'm sure they had a few better techniques on Hallowes's one than we had, because we were pretty much just the camera and a couple of reflectors, you know. So we were able to pull it off miraculously. But yeah, it's no way to make a movie. I'm not sure I ever want to do that again.
I never thought about that before. But what did the directors on location do for rushes? I mean, did they even have rushes?
No. Hallowes's one was probably slightly different than Brothers Grimm, because Hallowes's one was edited from a composite image, the same image you saw in your local movie theater, the CinemaScope image. They married optically printed all the dailies that way, and Harold Kress would then cut using a regular moviola with a CinemaScope bubble on the top, and he'd see this anamorph, and that's how he cut Hallowes's one. Brothers Grimm was cut in the old-fashioned travelogue way, where you actually had a six perf moviola. You would cut one panel, and then you'd conform the other two. So there were two different editing techniques going on there.
It just seems like a mind-bogglingly complicated
it is.
Thing from beginning to end. I can't even imagine.
And when you revive it like we did on In the Picture, it even gets worse, because there's certain pieces of equipment aren't available to you anymore, such as a six-perf moviola. We shot it at 26 frames per second, which is the true Cinerama speed from the travelogue days, which was nothing but a hassle when you add on the modern post-production to that, to come out the other end at 26 frames a second again.
So how did you cut it?
I edited it on video, and then I conformed the film. Now, that sounds easy. People did that every day in the when they were, you know, using Avid shows, and they would conform the film to it and go to preview with the film back in 10 years ago or whatever. It's a little different in Cinerama, because when you conform the film, you have no numbers that relate to any frame on that Cinerama film. You have to do it only visually. So you have to print out a frame grab of every cut you make and look for something in one of those three panels that match a dog lifting its leg on a fire hydrant, something that where two pieces of information that are converging, that becomes, and then you add three frames to that because you cut three frames after that. You don't edit this way. You edit first, and then you go back and find where you can conform. Mm-hmm. And that was a six or seven day process of conforming the Cinerama dailies to the work picture, the video work picture, by using frame grabs, a lot of ink, printing out the frame to go out into the garage then and conform the film. Each cut had to be done that way, every single edit.
Well, let's back up a little bit. You were talking about going to Ohio to see the kind of handmade Cinerama that guy did. And so how did you make the leap from that to starting to get into helping to restore the films themselves?
It was probably because of doing the documentary, we had to do a certain amount of that anyway. We had to do some Greg Kimball figured out a telecine system using PAL sideways with VistaVision gates to telecine the film. This is before scanning became a big deal. We're talking 2000 and 1999 now. So you would telecine it on its side, as if it were VistaVision, and you'd tell the computer to do six perfs instead of eight, VistaVision eight. Then you would converge them later in After Effects in a computer and put the panels together and add a fuzzy edge for the blend line. And that's how we did a bunch of the shots in the Cinerama Adventure documentary. We had the availability of some composite images, such as the 70mm of This is Cinerama. There is a composite image of Seven Wonders of the World, not the complete movie. So we picked and choosed our shots where we had to do that telecine process and where we didn't have to do that, because there was already some kind of a reference, such as the Hallowes was one. When we had clips, we used the 35 anamorphic that you saw as a kid. So it was a hodgepodge of different techniques to get those three panels back together again to use in a documentary. So there was a lot of investigative work to figure out the best way to do it, the cheapest way to do it, and all that stuff. And so I became one of the authorities on how to do all of this stuff, you know. And then
just by virtue of doing it,
being the first one to do it and figuring out different techniques to make it happen. Later on, of course, when Warner Brothers did How the West Was Won, they had very deep pockets. They could do anything they wanted to. And, you know, they scan everything at 40K or something. And you know, they did a wonderful job. But, you know, when you're a studio, you get to do those things. When you're not a studio and where you're operating basically off of a grant, which we are on these restorations, you have to make every penny count. And you end up working for free a lot to get it done, you know. So we had to figure out miracles, little miracles, to make things happen by virtue of not having, you know, a studio behind us to say, we need another $10,000 to do something, you know. It was, we need another 50 cents. It's basically what it was, you know.
How was the original material on these things? Did you have, did you find negatives of most of it, or?
No, it was in horrible shape. Seven Wonders. We're still working on Seven Wonders. Seven Wonders won't even be ready for the festival. We'll have a movie, and it'll have color, and it'll move, and it'll be seven channels or whatever. But the image quality is going to vary throughout the whole movie until we can rescan certain things and do them a different way. We're having to reinvent a few wheels there. The others are literally what I would call digital restorations because they look really good just by some new technology that's come down the pike. You know, at Image Trends, a company in Austin, Texas, which believes in the project to the point where their rates are cut severely in order to get this done. They knew what the grant money was, what we had to do for what we were going to try to do, and they are cooperating completely, which you don't find in this business anymore, you know.
How many films have you restored?
Right now, complete total restorations of Cinerama Holidays, completely done. South Seas Adventure, which we just got back from the Venice International. Imagine, the Venice International Film Festival wanted to run a Cinerama movie that I restored. You know, we didn't expect that. You know, we do get attention once in a while. Cinerama Holidays, South Seas Adventure, and then two of the 70 millimeters have been what I call remastered, because in order to call them a restoration, we went back to the original negatives. We did all that where we could, and then where we couldn't, we had to go from a faded print and put color back into it. But the one that was originally titled Scent of Mystery, a Cinerama movie, was retitled Holiday in Spain, went out to Cinerama theaters as Holiday in Spain in a 70mm and a three-panel version. That one was in pretty bad shape. So we've remastered those two titles with this same grant money. So we're getting a lot of stuff done for very little money. Russian Adventure was one that we got financed privately, but it's a remastering, but it looks like it did back in 1964 when it was played in 70mm, because that's all we had was the 70mm, you know, which was kind of grainy, and you know.
So when you show the digital restorations on the Cinerama screen, how close to Cinerama does it look?
It comes pretty close. They're still working on it. They're down there tonight working on it, trying to set the – I deliver them an anamorphic image that they're going to spread across the screen with a certain lens, and it pretty much fills the same screen as the Cinerama image did. There may be a little masking at the top. We're going to crop a little bit, but it's pretty much basically it. It's 2K. We can't afford a 4K image. Each one of the panels in these restorations we're doing is scanned at 3K. There's 3K masters of every frame, so it's future-proofed. But what we're dealing with and what the final color is, and we're marrying the sound, because we're doing it at 24 frames a second, that's all we can do at this point until somebody invents a 26 frames per second video stuff, you know. So we have to slow down the sound slightly to make it fit the picture now, to keep every frame intact, you know. But 10 years from now, we've built into this whole system that if you wanted to make this into IMAX, we've got 3K images of each one of those frames. They would have to be recolor corrected, though. They'd have to be reassembled or whatever, blended together again. We're dealing with a 2K composite where we're blending the images back together again for the first time in 50 years, and then doing color work on each one of those panels separately, the cleanup, the getting rid of bumps and grinds, and sometimes there's bad frames at a cut where we have to either duplicate the frame above it and just disguise it a little bit so it doesn't look too bad, So that's basically what we're doing to get Cinerama back up and running again. And it looks really good. It looks really good. I wish we could have done it for This Is Cinerama and Windjammer, but the negatives were in too bad a shape to do it, so we had to work with what we had to work with. Yeah.
Well, you know, as you know, I've seen Smilebox versions of several of these things, and they've always looked terrific in this situation, in the screening room situation.
Yeah.
So I'm really eager to see them at
the
Dome.
Well, you can. At the Dome, there, you're not technically seeing Smilebox. You're seeing the anamorphic version, because we do several versions of each one of these titles. Again, we're future-proofing everything. It mainly goes out for the consumer as Smilebox. You can run a Smilebox image on a curved screen, and it will fit just as good as if you ran the anamorphic. In fact, it fits better, because Smilebox is its own aperture plate. If you go to any of these old Cinerama theaters, or any of the, like the Dome or Seattle, and you go into their 70mm aperture plates and you pull one out and look at it, it's Smilebox. But it's cropping. And when we do Smilebox, we're not cropping. You're getting the top and the bottom of the image. Yeah. But it will fit on that screen. It will project as if it were an aperture plate. So miraculously, we weren't geniuses. We didn't plan it this way. It just, one of those benefits of, you can run Smilebox on a curved screen, and it fits perfectly.
Now, did you develop Smilebox?
It was a bunch of us. The concept was mine. And then Greg Kimball refined it. A guy named Brian Ross did sort of the final pass on it, who was at Laser Pacific. And then from here on out, we just have we have a different Smilebox for Windjammer than we do for This Is Cinerama, because Windjammer was on less of a curved screen in its original form. So we've kind of made it that way for Windjammer. This Is Cinerama, and the rest of them will be in the regular Smilebox format.
Windjammer was shot in Cinemiracle.
Cinemiracle, yeah.
Which was kind of like Cinerama, but not.
Right. It was different, but it was the same. another way of saying the same thing. It was a system that was completely compatible with each other. You just had to flop the film on Abel and Charlie when you ran Windjammer at a Cinerama theater, because they're not shooting it through mirrors now. It was shot through mirrors on those two to get it into one booth. So when you do run it in a Cinerama theater, you have to flop the film on Abel and Charlie.
Now, there are probably people listening who don't know what Smilebox is, so explain what.
It's a curved screen simulation. The people originally, I periodically I'll hear somebody on the internet or someone will ask me, well, I want it in Letterbox because that's the way the filmmaker intended it. Well, bull crap. It was not the way the filmmaker intended it, and just come and talk to me and I'll convince you differently. But everyone saw these on curved screens. They did not see Cinerama on any kind of a flat letterbox kind of situation whatsoever.
Then
you get
point?
People that, fortunately, everyone loves Smilebox, but there's a couple of these home theater guys who probably, you know, they're not going to like the fact that we've put curtains into these shows because they've got their own curtains. Well, I'm sorry, you're the exception. We're making this for the masses, so to speak. We're not making it for you, and you happen to have your own curtain. Same way, with there's one guy that was arguing, well, Smilebox isn't real Cinerama. Well, we never said it was. We said it's a simulation. Look at the logo. It says simulated curved screen. You know, how much plainer can you make it for people? But these guys on the internet and these blogs, they start talking about, well, I don't like, you know. But fortunately, George Feltenstein, the people at Warner Brothers, got nothing but great letters about how effective Smilebox was. Turner Classic Movies is going to start using Smilebox now.
Nice.
They're going to start it off with the Cinerama Adventure documentary, and they're going to run This Is Cinerama on October 18th, I believe it is, and it will be in Smilebox. And they tell me they're going to run How the West Was Won in Smilebox.
It's amazingly effective. And
it is.
I'm one of those people who had to be dragged kicking and screaming to look at it.
Yeah.
Because I thought Cinerama is so much a thing of itself that I don't trust anything that tries to be like it.
But when
I watched the Blu-ray of How the West Was Won on a pretty big screen, I think it was like 12 feet wide.
Yeah. Oh, that'll do it.
And it was pretty darn close to looking at Cinerama. Yeah. I mean, it's...
And we tested it intricately. People, you know, we didn't just come up with this highfalutin idea and shove it down people's throat. This was tested. At the Seattle Cinerama, we projected charts. We re-photographed them with video. Look at those little squares. Look what happens on the edge. You know, we did all of that stuff. More research than you could shake a stick at. Wanted to be sure. That's why when I made this documentary, Cinema Adventure, I got to make the whole thing exactly the way I wanted to do it. There was no executive, well, Dave, you can't do this. It's going to cost too much money. I had total freedom, just like I had total freedom on In the Picture, to make what we wanted to make there. No one was interfering with me and saying, you can't do this, you can't do that. If I had worked anywhere else, someone would have been there saying, you can't do this. You know, we're not going to do Smilebox because it's people are going to complain. No, I don't think they're going to complain that much. Yeah, there's always one or two that will. But yeah. It was, I would say, if for every 100 people that I've talked to, there's probably 97% think Smilebox is fantastic. And the others are just strange people.
Physics will tell you you can't show Cinerama on a video projector on a regular television.
Yeah,
it's only one screen. There's nothing you
right,
can do
yeah.
about that.
No. Huh.
So the best you can
this
do is...
This is the best you can do.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get right down to it, one guy, I read something, and I even answered this guy because he kind of pissed me off. One of these blogs, I was at midnight and I'm on the internet, and what are they saying about Smilebox? And there was this one guy that was just totally, you know, this is not the way it was meant to be and all this kind of stuff, and this is not simulating Cinerama, it's trickery, it's whatever it was he used, you know, and it's like, well, okay, how can you see Lawrence of Arabia on your home screen? You're not running 70 millimeter. Mm-hmm. It isn't the original mix that they saw in 1963. It isn't. There's all these things that you guys could be picking. If you're going to pick on me for Smilebox, then you got to pick on those guys for that. Because technically, you shouldn't be watching Letterbox. You should shut down your home theater, go down to your local theater, convince them to run a 70mm print, and now you've got it. So where do you want to draw the line? You know. So.
Well, that's why this is such a great thing. This upcoming event at the Cinerama Dome, which I have tickets for most everything, including In the Picture, of which I blushingly admit I'm one of the major stars.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Right. We see the back of your.
Yeah, just see my back for about 4 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think it's the highlight of the movie. I think anybody would agree.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell us. Yeah. Let's plug this and talk about what you're going to be showing and what each print is going to look like there.
Well, it's a good question because they're still testing it. Everything should look fine. There's always the possibility things are going to go wrong. There's always the possibility Cinerama could break down.
That's life.
We have breakdown reels, which we're going to show whether they break down or not, but we'll show
those anyway. Things are a hoot.
Yeah, and there's a couple of surprises coming up on those.
Right.
These are things that I've collected over the years, or people have sent me, like John Mitchell in Australia, and there's a projectionist in New Zealand that sent me one of the breakdown reels years ago that I was using for the Cinerama Adventure documentary, and I've just kept copies here. You know.
Again, to tell people, the breakdown reels were things that they would hurriedly put up if something went wrong during the Cinerama, and the ones I've seen have been primarily Lowell Thomas,
mm-hmm.
just saying, well, it looks like something's gone wrong, and he'll talk a little bit.
Yeah.
And if you see several of them in a row, it starts to get pretty hysterically funny, just him going,
Well,
so I guess they're still not fixed.
It's funnier. It's sort of like I equate this with when you're in a large crowd. And let's say you're at home and you're going to watch your old Laserdisc of Mad World or whatever on your little TV screen. You know, you're not your 70 millimeter room. You know, of course that guy I was talking about earlier not going to be able to do this, but you're watching it. And I ran it one night for my wife, and she, this isn't that funny. Wow, what's such a big deal? I said, no, but the scene coming up and Dick Shawn and I'm getting ready to laugh, but I don't. Go down to the dome, watch it in a crowd, and you will laugh. So the same thing goes with these breakdown reels. If you see them naked without anybody around you, it's kind of like, this is weird, you know. But if you see it in a crowd, it becomes hilarious. And it wasn't intended to be hilarious.
No.
You know, necessarily. That was one that was. And that's the one for Search for Paradise where Dmitri Tiomkin and Lowell Thomas are in front of a curtain and they're talking. And and you can barely understand Dmitri. and Lowell is complimenting on his almost doesn't have an accent anymore kind of thing, you know. So,
yeah, let's talk about some of the things that are going to be showing.
Everything is going to be showing pretty much in some form or another. I'd say Golden Head, which is a very rare one to see, is pretty. You could almost call that restored because the original negative was in pristine condition. Holiday in Spain or Scent of Mystery is a little bumpy, but it's not too bad. Then the two major restorations are Cinerama Holiday and South Seas Adventure.
Yeah, talk about what's going to be three panel.
Oh, yeah.
And then what's going to be
digital. We'll call it digital three panel is Cinerama Holiday and South Seas Adventure. Those are complete digital restorations.
in three panel is Search for Paradise, rare Eastman color print, because they all Cinerama prints, even though they said Technicolor, were really Eastman color, except Hal West's one, Brothers Grimm, and one or two prints of This is Cinerama in the 60s.
So is the color any good on this?
The color is going to be pink on Search for Paradise. Seven Wonders of the World will be digital. Part of it is the restored scans. Part of it is a composite done by Linwood Dunn years ago, similar to the 70mm This is Cinerama, but I don't think done as well because it was done in CinemaScope as opposed to Cinerama. So we're in corporate, it's sort of a checkerboard arrangement, but it's the complete movie, even including one of the missing scenes. Then Hal the West is One, of course, is three panel, the current print, the 2002 print. And Brothers Grimm is an archival print from the same gentleman who provided Search for Paradise. That print is coming from Bradford because now that print is on deposit at Bradford. It's IB Tech, but it is in bumpy kind of condition. It's all showable if you really love the movie. If you're not, you're going to say, why couldn't they get a better print?
Well,
this is the only print.
I've waited my whole life to see this because I obviously have never had a chance to see it in Cinerama, so I'm happy to get what I can get.
Yeah, that's the attitude you should have with Grimm and perhaps even Seven Wonders at this point until we can finish it. And Search for Paradise eventually will be finished as well, but it's taking a lot longer because you can't schedule something like these restorations and meet a schedule when you're dealing on the kind of budget we're dealing on. And, you know, if it was a studio, you just throw more bodies at it and you send it to India and whatever you're going to do. You know, we're doing it all here. This is an American thing going on here, you know. And we're cleaning it up here. Everything's being done here. So that was all the titles, I think, plus a lot of extras. Oh, and A Mad, Mad World is in 70mm. You'll see it in Ultra Panavision. Is there another one I'm forgetting? Besides Golden Head, Holiday in Spain, lots of breakdown reels and old...
Oh, Windjammer?
Of course, Windjammer. The first one I worked on, actually. Yeah. That is, again, the Linwood Dunn version. That is also going to be, I believe, on sale in the lobby. Windjammer and This is Cinerama. Those are both done... We call them remasterings, not restorations, because we didn't have... we had access to the original materials, but they were unusable. Now, someone might argue that point. Yes, they are usable if you can throw a couple $1,000,000 at it. We'll fix it for you. Write the check. But we can't on the budget that we had. We had to go with the Linwood Dunn situation, which was not ideal. Linwood Dunn is honored among Hollywood effects people, and we're not trying to criticize him here, but he was probably told to do this very low budget. So he set up a rear screen projector and projected three panels on it and re-photographed it with another camera. That's how Windjammer was done. That's how this version of Seven Wonders was done, which we're rebuilding from the original negative.
Well, I saw Windjammer here.
At the Dome?
No, in your living room.
In the living room, okay.
And I thought it looked terrific. I mean, I never
would. It's going to be fine for home video. I'm sure people, when this comes out, they're going to be picking on it. I saw two pixels off to the left that were out of alignment or something. But this is it, guys. You're not going to see it any other way. So criticize away. Walk a mile in my shoes, and you'll be surprised how much extra time we spent on that to make it look as good as it did. And it isn't perfect, of course.
I didn't think it betrayed. I mean, telling me what you just told me about what Dunn did.
That's what we had to work with.
It sounded like it would be awful, but in fact it looked nice.
It looked as good as you're going to get with what we have off-the-shelf software right now.
And you did a lot of color correction and so forth.
We did panel line helpers. We did all kinds of stuff. We did the show over in Bradford. We just came back from Venice where we did a similar show, but on the new way we're doing these things now because we have the grant to do the scanning. And we had people coming up after us and saying, my God, you know, and I said, how did you guys figure this stuff out? And, well, it wasn't that we're all geniuses. It's there was no really other way to do it, you know. And I know that at Venice they were running the new restoration of Heaven's Gate or the new restoration of, you know, you name it. There's a couple of movies that were, you know, we were just the Cinerama contingent, right? Yeah. But we were the only ones doing a seminar on digital restoration, right? And my last comment at this august assembly was, I wish I had a 1984 negative to deal with instead of three rotten ones that barely have sprocket holes left.
Yeah.
Boy, that would be a, you know, so don't brag to me about your restoration. I didn't have sprocket holes.
Wow.
Little exaggeration there.
Well, I think one of the coolest things, I don't know if this is telling tales out of school, so let me know. But tell me about in Holiday in Spain, a.k.a. Son of Mystery, tell me about the credit sequence that we see at the end of that.
Oh, yeah. Mike Todd always, well, at least in Around the World in 80 Days, he used Saul Bass, which was, you know, did this wonderful. It's always at the end credits. It was never a big credit up front like most movies were in 1956. It was the end. So when Holiday in Spain, when Send of Mystery came out, it had no credits at all other than copyright something at the end as Elizabeth Taylor and Denholm Ellender walking off into the sunset. And we were just, well, there's got to be an element here. So we searched up and down the vaults to find it. And then finally we read some review somewhere that said, and they didn't have any credits. They handed out the booklet that had the credits in it, right? So we figured, well, maybe they never made credits for this movie. And so, but this is going to look stupid. We'll have to explain that, you know. So I spent about 3 days. I got some images from an original program booklet of Scent of Mystery from a friend of mine, Bruce Kimmel. And I scanned them, and my wife and went into Photoshop and did all kinds of stuff with them. And we created a Saul Bass-like end credit. Have you seen it?
I have.
You have seen that grand? And it does. Has that Around the World in 80 Days feel to it and all that stuff, you know. And, of course, we finally give Elizabeth Taylor credit. Not quite. We call her Liz. We spell her name backwards. You know, we didn't want to give it away. And everybody, including the august director of photography for all the J. Arthur Rank movies, the Powell Pressburger guys.
Jack Cardiff?
Jack Cardiff was the director of this movie. And Peter Lorre and all these guys. So we gave everyone the credit. We did a research, found out who all the credit was. And at the very, very end, after spending 4 days on this, I said, well, I'm going to give myself credit. So I had this crawl with all the secretaries and the interpreters or whatever we want. And I said, the very last thing is this, at the very crawl, is main title design. I was going to say Dave Saul Bass Strohmeyer on there. But I just put Dave Strohmeyer on there. So I gave myself credit on the end.
Well, as well you
it
should.
It was pretty intricate, actually. Yeah,
yeah, and it's fun to watch. I mean,
it really is.
It really does capture that era perfectly. I mean, it looks just like.
And I showed it to Susan Todd, Mike Todd's daughter, and because I posted it on the internet so she could see it, and she said, "Dad would have loved this." So, okay, well, you can't do better than that. So, now wait for the blogs when they criticize the end credit. I'm going to say, this is authorized by the Todd family, folks, so get off it.
Yeah, if you don't like it, just turn it off.
Yeah, right.
You know when the movie's over, just flip it off.
Right, yeah.
Which one of these things was the most problematic for you?
I would have to say the one that was sort of the least problematic was Southsea's Adventure. Because the negative was in better shape than the other titles. Cinerama Holiday had fading on the edges, which we still can't quite get rid of. In other words, you have a shot, and the edges turned a little bit blue on each side. They're kind of disguised now, and you don't notice it after. Wait, have you seen Cinerama Holiday?
Yeah.
You probably didn't notice it, but it's there, and I notice it every time, of course. But that one was problematic. This is Cinerama was a huge problem. Windjammer was a huge problem. And I'm hoping Search for Paradise will be more like Southsea's Adventure. It'll go smoother. Seven Wonders is the worst because seven reels of negative are missing. So we've gotten the cooperation of the Library of Congress, and we do scan their deposit print on any missing scene. We have a complete inventory of every scene in every one of these movies, where its footage is, how long it is, how many frames it is. We have done tons of research before we started this project. I got notebooks full of stuff you wouldn't believe, you know. And I can call Larry Smith at the Library of Congress and say, at 322 feet into Act 2, is the missing scene that I need, and it starts with a splice of a guy holding a candle or whatever, you know, the description is. I send him a frame grab that I have of the temp composite, and then he can identify that, pull that knot in that negative, that print, faded pink print, send it to Austin, Texas. They then scan it, put as much color back into it as they can, and deliver me a composite, which then I dovetail into the rest of the movie and adjust the color so it doesn't look like a faded print that has adjusted color. You know, it looks more natural than you would, than I'm describing it. But it looks pretty good. And I've shown a couple of these reels to people, including a professional colorist, because I've never done color correction before. And so I would take a few shots that I didn't quite like to a colorist, and he'd say, I think you did a pretty good job here, Dave. I would add a little more blue in the, you know, whatever, you know, and I'd say, so I started building confidence in myself and able to do this, you know. Another colorist would have a different interpretation probably, but I was getting a professional guy guiding me here and there to make sure I wasn't, because we couldn't afford them. We had a budget of $400 for color correction on each one of these movies. $400 freaking. How do you do that?
You do it for that.
No, you couldn't. You do it in my office on my computer at the wee hours of the morning. Then you take what you're not sure about to a professional colorist. He looks at it, puts it up on his scopes and all his equipment, and says, well, maybe you should not. I wouldn't. That's okay.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Windjammer, because it seems like you've had some interesting experiences with that.
Interesting thing about the Windjammer score, which is a wonderful score, mm-hmm. We've located all the recording sessions.
Nice.
And a guy named Robert Weisberger has had all these transferred. Now, they're mono, but they're really first generation, and they're able to do a faux stereo to it. They're doing that right now, actually. And I think it's going to come out, not right away, but eventually through RCA at some point, or some other distributor. But it'll be the complete Windjammer sessions. I mean, you'll hear them, you know, doing slates and everything in there, you know.
I must say, the first time I saw Windjammer, I thought it would be a documentary with some dramatized elements.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it to be as musical as it is. There's lots of songs in it.
Yeah, lots of songs in it. And the part of the thing we did on Windjammer, once it was done, we were invited by the it's not AMIA. What is it? The FIC something, or it's Restoration Group. They do paper, and they have the convention every year. And AMIA is somehow invited or part of it. I'm not sure what the deal is.
But FIOF.
That's it. That's it. I'm sorry. I never get these abbreviations right.
What I meant to say was, you're speaking of FIOF.
Yeah, FIOF. The Norwegian government invited me, my wife, and Randy to come over and run Windjammer as part of this FIOF thing they did in Oslo 2 years ago. So we had just finished the restoration. We take it over there. We run it. It looks pretty darn good. And they have a 4K projector, which I guess does some kind of enhancing. I don't know. But it looked really good. And all these cadets were coming out of the woodwork that were in the movie. They were showing up at these screenings. They had about 3 screenings there, you know. So I'm taking down names and numbers and, you know, including the guy that sings Carrie Waits for Me, who is, you know, since died last December. But I said, we've got to film these guys. We've got to get a crew together and shoot. Now, I can't afford to go back to Norway. I mean, they paid for it. Norway's expensive. But a friend of mine lives in Denmark, the N70mm, Thomas Havislav, the N70mm guy, is a big website on widescreen. He went over and shot some interviews, and a local Norwegian guy who was really into this, sort of a young filmmaker type, helped organize this whole thing. I just bankrolled it, basically expenses and pizza after the interviews. And they shot these interviews with these cadets, and we cut together what I was hoping to be a 15-20-minute documentary, so that when it did go out on home video, you'd have some extra with it, you know, instead of the breakdown reel and nothing else, right? You know, it ended up being an hour-long documentary. And I don't know if you were at that screening, but we invited some people over here to the house, and we ran it one night.
I saw it here.
You saw it here, that Windjammer documentary? Yeah. And so the first thing if you remember that night, the first thing I said is, okay, who fell asleep and where? You know? And I had Harrison Engel here, who's a professional, made many documentaries in his life, and he said, Dave, don't change a thing. It's perfect. Leave it alone, you know. And that's going out. And we ran it in Bradford. It got a standing ovation.
Again, for people who don't know what Windjammer is and won't know why there were cadets, tell them a little bit about what that...
It was a training ship that trained cadets for the Norwegian Navy, I guess. And it's still being used as that, as well as other things. And they made this movie in 1958 as part of a rival widescreen process. So that shows you that Cinerama was so popular that it spawned a rival at a rival theater company. And to get around the patents, they called this thing Cinemiracle, and they hired all the people that originally developed Cinerama, minus Fred Waller, he had died, Dick Babish and all the other guys, Tom Conroy and everything, they hired them because they were now out of work. Cinerama is now out there and developed, and how do we get around the patents and deliver something similar? They hired all these guys. They came up with a system. They called it CineMiracle, and it went out, threatened Cinerama with its popularity, and eventually Cinerama got some money together and bought CineMiracle. And then it became a CineMiracle movie presented in Cinerama. That's how they did it. In other words, they flopped the film and the and they ran it at Cinerama theaters. But there were CineMiracle theaters. There were several of them. The Grauman's Chinese, for one, you know, and a couple of them. There's one in Toronto. They just didn't have as deeply curved screen, and it wasn't a louvered screen. There was a ship that sank called the Pamir, which is in the movie, which is a German ship. The Christian Radek also sank during World War. It was sunk by the Nazis. It was sitting at the bottom of I forgot the name of the town where they have submarine bases or something. That's the Christian Radek was kind of stolen from the Norwegians. Mm. So then they, after the war, they brought it back up again because they were going to float it back to Norway and just melt it down and make steel, you know, whatever. And they found out it was going to be more expensive to tear it apart than it was to restore it.
Wow.
So they restored it. Now they're so glad. It's that ship is like to Norway what almost the American flag is, or the seal of the United States or whatever. That's a symbol of Norway, is the Christian Radek. And it still is today. And it's I've been on it twice because of restoring this movie. I know where the toilets are. I know where they're, you know, I know this movie like the back of my hand. So I'm walking on this ship, and my wife is with me, and she was involved in some of these restorations too. And we're like, this is like, it's almost like the Twilight Zone. We're on the ship. We've been looking at this thing for months, and now we're actually on it. And they would provide us dinner on the ship. We got to sit in the same area where you see in the movie, and then like 6 months later we're invited to go to Denmark because the Christian Radek's going to be there, and they wanted to show Windjammer again, and we got invited to Denmark, and we got another dinner on the ship. And while I was at this place, I recorded another little extra for the Windjammer DVD called The Windjammer Today or something, you know. It shows the ship today, and it's in Aalborg where we had all these screenings. And the head of the Windjammer Association is named Erwin Einar Corwin, was there. And so I shot an interview with him as he talks about the ship and preserving it. And so that's one of the other extras. There's lots of extras on these new DVDs, you know. They were all provided by me, but of course. We didn't have any budget to make these, so, you know.
There must have been a lot of production shots done of these films, or production films done when these films were released, weren't they? I mean, it had to be such a novelty, just the way they were being made, that it seems like people must have been there documenting all this.
Stills. We found a whole bunch of stills on the making, which are part of this DVD release, Blu-ray release. There's a lot of that. There is some home movies that were shot by one of the crew members who provided us with some home movies, 8mm, which we had telecine and we cut to in our documentary and stuff. So, but there wasn't there was an established cinematographer that shot regular 35mm because they were going to use some of that in the prologue, because a lot of these movies started out with a 1:33 prologue before they opened up to widescreen, and they had a guy shooting that. All of that footage was lost. The outtakes and everything were lost. Or there would have been a ton of stuff there of behind the scenes that we could have used. But we had enough behind the scenes that you'll see what's going on, and more than most movies have, really. You know. But as far as somebody really documenting it with, it was just accidental 8mm home movies and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I've seen some How the West Was Won footage, but not,
that's
not as
Lauren
much as
Jane.
You would think.
That's Lauren Jane's home movies. He had a 16mm.
One of the stuntmen.
Right? He had a 16mm camera. He shot roll after roll of Kodachrome, you know, with his camera, and that is what we used in Cinerama Adventure to illustrate. And he still does lecture tours and stuff at various film festivals where he shows some of that footage. You know, he'll be at the screenings of How the West Is Won. So will Stanley Livingston, and Russ Tamblyn is scheduled to be at the first screening of Grimm. And we almost had Claire Bloom the other day, but she had to fly away. She's going to be in town the day before and couldn't stay an extra day or something.
That's
so,
too bad.
Yeah. And we have the Alex North family's going to be there for Southsea's Adventure. Who else? Mrs. Dmitry Tyomkin is supposed to be there. And some of the actresses, the two young girls that were in South Seas Adventure, they're mm-hmm. both going to be there. I'm probably forgetting somebody.
Well, one of those was here when you showed it in your living room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Marlene. Yes.
Yeah. I was here for that. Yeah.
Well, the other girl is Diane Beardmore, or Diane Patton, and she's flying in from New York to be at the screening. And then the Carl Dudley family, there's various members of the Carl Dudley family, the producer of South Seas Adventure, that are going to be in the audience. Yeah. So.
Yeah, Tamblyn was about the only actor who was in both dramatic films.
There were actually more,
films.
But I don't usually say that to Russ. the kids, and Brothers Grimm was one of the kids. Was in Hal West was one. Clinton Spilsbury, I think is his name. He played the lawyer for Debbie Reynolds when she goes back. He goes backstage and says, "You've won a there's a gold mine waiting for you." You know, he was also in Brothers Grimm,
that
and I think he was Jim Backus's. henchman or something.
Clinton Spilsbury was a guy who played Lone Ranger in that awful remake.
No, this is somebody. His name sounds like that. He's a character actor from the. You know, he was in both films, and I think there was one other person that was in both movies too. You know, but as far as stars, yeah, Russ is it.
Probably nobody had the patience to do it twice, right?
Well, I think the people under contract just got in front of the camera when they were asked to. You know, sure. It's the real actors that had to do the. Reacting were the ones that were complaining. So,
you know, when I watch How the West Was Won, because I've had a chance now to see it, I think, five times in Cinerama. Yeah. I mean, in three-panel Cinerama. The last couple of times, I made it a point to always look away from the action.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a fun thing to do.
Well, you're looking at different stuff then.
Yeah. Because there's always something going on, mm-hmm. and they couldn't afford to have anybody, like in a regular movie, four blocks down, an extra can pretty much just stand there. But for Cinerama, you can see what everybody's doing, and so when you look away from the action, it's really interesting what you see. And
you know who'd been a good Cinerama director?
Who?
Cecil B. DeMille. Because every extra knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Every extra had something they had to do. And you know,
He would have
filled up each one of those panels with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I knew Charles Barton, who was one of his assistant directors, and of course the director himself later on. But he told me a story one time about how he, I think, I can't remember which one it was on, but Sign of the Cross maybe, but it was his job to go and tell every extra what they were doing and who they were, and he just went out and said, "Everybody act busy." And DeMille almost killed him. It was a mistake he didn't make twice.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But it's fun to watch away from the action, because you see strange things.
Yeah.
And you also see when they would double people or just have, like the scene I always think of is they're all on the shore, I think, when they're burying the people after the raft, you know,
mom and dad,
And off at some distance is James Stewart, but it ain't James Stewart, and it's and when you look at him, it's just not even close.
Yeah.
It's like and there are several things in there. When you mention Lauren James, it's always fun to watch him being the doubles for
everybody. Yeah.
And even Debbie Reynolds, and it's Debbie Reynolds suddenly sprouts a hairy arm. And
I asked Lauren about that. I said, "How come you didn't shave your arm that day?"
Yeah, there's several things. It's funny, and I know that you, having watched these things a gazillion times, it probably cataloged all this stuff, but the other James Stewart thing that always kills me is when they bring in his dead body and put him head first toward
right
the camera, and
yeah.
it doesn't resemble James Stewart in any way. When they say, "This is Linus Rawlings," you go, "No, it's not."
They should have put more blood on him.
Yeah, something.
But, you know, when we saw that back in 1964, it didn't cross our brains at all. You know, we didn't look down and say, "Is that James Stewart?" Yeah. Well, the travelogues are fun in that way, too, because everybody's looking into the camera.
Mm.
So it gives you that kind of, I guess, creepy feel, but that's not the right word, but it's like, are they looking at me? Yes. Are you looking at me?
They're violating
you're dead, and it's 50 years ago when you were looking at me.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a creepy feeling, but everybody looked in the camera. And Cinerama Holiday is full of that.
They're
dollying down a fairground, and people are walking. They're getting out of the way. What is this thing coming? And there's grandmothers who are running and grabbing their kids and pulling them away from the camera so they don't get run over, you know. We call them virtual reality time capsules.
Yeah.
That's what we kind of coined that phrase for the travelogues, you know. And it's true. When you look at some of these things, and it's the Vegas sequence in Cinerama Holiday is a riot with, you know, dollying down these old slot machines, which were the modern best thing in those days, you know. And that street, the main drag, is just like, you know, tumbleweeds blowing across it.
Yeah.
And it's just an interesting thing to see that moment in time. And then to go inside to one of the dancing girls are now on a Vegas show, there'd be 400 girls on stage or something. You know, there was like 8.
Wow,
that was a big show. You know, how quaint.
Yeah, it really is. It is like traveling through time in some weird way, and it's like they were making an extra documentary they didn't even know they were making.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. I mean, you've mentioned in the picture, but how in the world did that get started?
It was kind of a long story. We'd always thought, wouldn't it be great someday to fix up that old camera and shoot a couple of feet of film, you know, and see what modern film stocks look like on the Cinerama screen and blah, blah, blah.
Now, did someone just own this camera? Did someone you know, did you own it? Or
no, it's all in storage. A lot of this stuff is in storage. The thing that we borrowed from other people are some of the peripheral equipment that somehow gravitated into collectors' hands over the years. When Cinerama was broken apart in 1978, when they lost their Forum Theater, a lot of the stuff was in storage, you know, including the negatives. The film library of all these outtakes was tossed in the city dump, you know, be a wonderful resource. So the cameras existed. There were 5 or 6 of them. One of them got lost in the river raft in Search for Paradise. And so we picked out the one that we thought would be easiest to restore. And but anyway, getting back to how it happened, it was basically talk. We were going to be, at one point, we were going to not restore all of these movies. We were going to restore a best of all of these movies and make a separate feature out of it. And this was a proposal that was discussed with the people in Seattle, Vulcan Entertainment, the Paul Allen people, because they had a Cinerama theater up there. So they had me go up to several meetings, and we were discussing things. And I said, well, one of the things I would like to do is shoot something with the old camera. And in other words, do an update. We'll save what we can of each one of these travelogues, not having known the condition of all the negatives or what was missing or what wasn't yet. We had to start that inventory to find out. But at the time, we hadn't. So I said, the best thing to do, if we're going to put some money into this, is to just create a new best of Cinerama with the existing footage, find the best scenes, and then end our little production by shooting something new. And one of the things I thought would be to go to Vegas and shoot the same thing as the Cinerama, you know, to show what Vegas looks like now. Not that we don't know, but, you know, I mean, to contrast it. We threw around names, who'd be the Lowell Thomas character, you know, of course, and since Martin Scorsese had seen Cinerama Adventure and liked it, we thought, well, let's get him, and he had a relationship with the Seattle people anyway, so he would be perfect as our host. Start him off in a 1:33 black and white prologue and have it, as he walks towards the camera, develop into color and walk by all these cameras that represent the history of film, you know, ending up with the red camera or whatever, you know. And then backtrack to the Cinerama camera and say, but what if we, you know, let's take a look at this, you know. And then we were just going to write something really clever with new narration using a lot of this footage and, of course, using Lowell Thomas here and there and try to create a nice, tight little 2-hour with an intermission movie that would end up with new photography. Then that idea got next somewhere along the line. And so then we got a grant from the family that owns the ArcLight. The sort of the chairman of the board of ArcLight I'd been warning everybody for years that this stuff is rotting, and if you don't do something about it, you know, you're paying for all this storage. It's an asset, or you wouldn't be storing it. So do something with it, you know. And of course, now that DVD sales are down, now we're doing something with it, right? But for years, we were trying to get them to do something with it. And so part of that was a grant. So we got a grant for money, and then it was my job to take that amount of money and see what we could do with it. How much could we restore? Can we get everything? Can we do half of it? What is it going to work? So, of course, I immediately had to cut my salary to make it all come together, as well as several other people, volunteer slash expenses paid type people, you know. And then we figured out that we could shoot something with the camera. So Ken Stone of Stone Engineering took the camera, started fixing it up, and did what he had to do to make it work again. And we started shooting a very loose script about a looking around at stuff in L.A., you know. But it had to be kind of clever because it's got to be, well, it's not really that clever, but it's just, it's a travelogue is what it is. So we're not trying to create Lawrence of Arabia here. We're just trying to entertain you for a few moments while you look at this rare footage that had been shot with a camera that is 60 years old. And so I wrote a little script about walking around L.A., and yet it ended up at the Cinerama Theater at the end, just like Cinerama Holiday had that. Those couples ended up meeting at the Cinerama Theater, so we kind of homage to Cinerama Holiday. So we filmed it, and what a pain that was. Just a huge, huge nightmare. But when you're halfway through it, you can't give up. You got to keep going. You know, you got to finish it. You know, and it's done. And it looks good, and the colors are bright, and it's in three-panel, and it's got a seven-channel mix.
Wow.
And it runs at 26 frickin' frames a second, which would kill me.
Now, how long is it?
It's 28 minutes long. It started off to be a 12-minute short. Ended up being 28 minutes long. Yep. So,
I can't wait to see it.
So. Oh, okay. Well, if you don't like it, don't tell me.
I'll lie about it.
You know.
I have a feeling I'm going to be in the positive camp on that thing. Before we stop, let's just do a good solid plug for the upcoming festival. Give me the dates on it, and
starts the 28th of September through October 4th. One of the bigger nights, I guess, is the Sunday, the September 30th, which is the real 60th anniversary of the premiere of This is Cinerama. That's who I forgot to mention. There's two original crew members are coming to that Sunday night thing. They're going to be here the whole weekend, actually. One of them is the stepson of Fred Waller, the inventor of Cinerama. He's going to be there with his wife. And Jim Morrison, who was on the original crew for several of these movies, including This is Cinerama, was there day one, is going to be there, and his family. In fact, his nephew was our sound man on In the Picture. And he sought us out because his uncle said, you know, that crazy Strohmeyer is actually filming a movie with this process. You ought to get involved in that. And I get this phone call. What do you need? Where do you want me? You know, and his name is Lincoln Morrison, and he's the nephew of one of the original crew members, you know.
That's something. So you're going to, it's going to be This is Cinerama that night, September 30th?
Yeah.
And also In the Picture that night,
In the Picture
too.
Will play, I think, right after or right before that. So double whammy, I guess. And but, you know, This is Cinerama is still that print that we made in 2002. It's not perfect. It couldn't be perfect. You can't make a perfect print off that anymore. You know, it's got shows fading and everything. But there's color. The sky's blue. The grass is green.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So.
No, I saw it the first time you showed it, and of course it was my first Cinerama experience, so it was memorable, and I didn't really register any major faults with it.
Okay.
I just thought it was terrific. So,
well, it's the only way you're going to see it, so
yeah.
Anybody who wants to pick on it can pick on it, but they ain't ever going to see it any other way, so you might as well settle down.
Yeah. Well, this stuff, I urge everybody I know to come see this stuff because they, you know, we live in a television time and people more and more think that because their TVs are high def and all that stuff that they're seeing films the way they should be seen. But these things really need to be, I mean, it's almost like a live performance. It really needs to be in a theater. I mean, as I say, I was very impressed with Smilebox, and I enjoy watching and everything, but you can't compare with that gargantuan screen and that great sound, and it's like you're totally immersed in the film. It's really something.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing, and I suppose it's like when people probably first saw Omnimax or maybe even IMAX. I don't know. I've never been super impressed with IMAX. It's done some great stuff. I mean, you know.
It's just big.
It's big. It's 133. It's big. You know?
Yeah.
And Omnimax I was more impressed with because that came somewhat close to a Cinerama feel, a feeling of involvement and stuff, you know. And sometimes in IMAX theaters, when you sit up close, you get a little bit of that feel, you know, but it's, you know. I was always told this story that when they revived Cinerama in Bradford, England at the National Media Museum, I think his name was Graham Ferguson, one of the inventors of IMAX, flew over there because he had never seen Cinerama. Imagine someone our age never having seen. And and he saw this, and one of his comments, this is all alleged, but it sounds true, so I'll repeat it, said something about, if I'd only seen this before we started on IMAX. So I always fantasize that, yep, IMAX would be on a curved screen now. And darn.
It would have been so much cooler.
Yeah, right.
And especially now, what they claim as IMAX when you go.
Oh, yeah, those. It's water it down.
Oh, right? Man. Yeah. It's really a shame.
Yeah.
But I guess, except for in the picture, we're really never going to see a Cinerama revival, are we?
I don't think so, no. I mean, they better get somebody else to direct it if they're going to. But, I mean, there is talk of another grant and stuff like that, but it's, you know, this was such a pain. That,
yeah.
And I did it for practically nothing, so to do that again would be, you know, they'd have to pay me.
What are the odds?
Yeah, right.
But, you know, things still keep happening. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master is shot in 70 millimeter.
And it's doing well.
Yeah.
It's filling the theater, you know. Yeah. And that's what's been delaying us all week at the Dome was the 70 millimeter. Because when we can't do our Cinerama test because the 70 millimeter sits in the same position as the Cinerama Baker projector. So we have to do all that stuff. John has to do all that stuff late at night and stuff after the show is over, you know.
So you're saying the Master is making
your
life harder.
The Master is making our life harder, yes. But I'm glad they filmed it in 70 millimeter, and it's. I bet you it'll happen again based on the popularity of this, assuming it becomes a popular movie. Now, it's popular in big cities, but will it carry it back to, you know, everywhere?
Yeah, how many places nationwide are capable of showing 70 millimeter?
Yeah, and they didn't make that many prints, but they're 35 prints. It's him and the guy who did Dark Knight... Chris Nolan, they're all film nuts.
Yeah.
They want to see film, you know. So they're forcing it down the studio's throat, I guess. You know.
Well, God bless them. I'm glad that somebody's sticking up for film.
Yeah, now if we can just get everybody to keep making the stuff, you know.
Well, I've always been so impressed with what you've done, and always I just look forward to when I come over here and you're showing your latest version of something. And it's just... all this stuff I've never had a chance to see. So it's really been opening up a whole world that I never had access to, and it's great.
Yeah, kind of equate it to silent movies in a way. Not that Cinerama is silent, but it's like they're offbeat. The young kids may not like it. How many young kids turn to classic movies on a Sunday night to see The Sign of Zorro or whatever, you know, and I'll flip channels every once in a while, and I'll get hooked on it, you know. And there are silent film societies all over the world that appreciate these things. There's festivals every year, you know. So Cinerama fits within that category of being something unusual, something different, and you can't always see it. And so, you know, it has its place in history.
Yeah. It's I've resolved that as long as I live in Los Angeles, whenever a real Cinerama film shows at the Dome, I'm going to go see it.
Yeah.
Because I know it's rare.
It could stop any day.
And I'm never going to have that many chances to see it no matter what. So it's really something. And everybody listening to this should go there.
And I always have to have a little bit of a laugh to some people. Like, for example, Brothers Grimm will never, ever play here again. And someone was talking to someone a couple of days ago, and they said, "Oh, I'm going to be out of town. My aunt is having her toenails painted that weekend, and I can't go." You know, and I say, "You better come."
Yeah.
And forget about who you promised that you'd be at a dinner. Call in sick.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to see this again.
This is your shot.
Yeah. This is your shot, and this is it. You ain't going to get another chance. Well, I have to get on a plane, and then borrow money from mom and dad, or. Whatever, this is it. Other than that, you're going to have to fly to London, get on a train, and go to Bradford, because they'll probably run it in the next couple of years somewhere in Bradford.
Yeah.
Until the print wears out. Yeah.
Are you getting a sense at this point of of what the ticket sales are like? Are there certain films that are really going better than others? I would think, yeah, Brothers Grimm would be.
We were surprised that Brothers Grimm is doing okay. It's doing fine, but I would have thought that these people would be forgetting about Aunt Martha's toenails and getting on that plane, yeah, or that car and driving to L.A. to see it. And they're making all these excuses why they can't. You know, they got to change the air in their bicycle tire. Then they got to, you know. So just get a life and come out, because you can't. I keep warning them, you're not going to see this again. They're not going to ship this print over to L.A. again. This was a special favor, you know, and it ain't going to happen again. So you better come to see. There's only two showings, you know. Hopefully the print's going to hold up, and we don't have a breakdown reel for Brothers Grimm, so
yeah,
it'll be me up there doing Jimmy Stewart impressions or something. But
I have a feeling it's going to be one of those things that after I watch it, I'll think, why didn't I buy tickets to both showings?
Well, either that, or you'll say it's not as good as I thought it was.
Well,
you know, How the West Was Won is technically a better movie. It's better made and all that. How the West Was Won isn't all Cinerama.
No.
Every frame on that screen for Brothers Grimm is in Cinerama. So it's a real Cinerama production, where How the West Was Won has a couple of 70mm shots here and there, you know. But it's really a kid's film.
Yeah.
It's really what it is.
I don't necessarily expect all that much from it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but nevertheless, yeah, I don't care how good it is.
Yeah.
I know this is my shot to see it. I know this is it.
So
whether it's good or bad is completely irrelevant to me.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I hope it's good, but I don't care if it is or not. It doesn't matter to me.
That's the attitude I go with too.
Yeah.
You know.
But I felt the same way, you know, last March we went up to Oakland to see Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to not the last show, but the next to the last one, I think. But as soon as it was over, I thought, why didn't I come here last week and just buy tickets to every show?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Because I could have just watched it again and again and again. Yeah. It was just such an incredible experience.
Yeah.
And that's why I always, you know, How the West Was Won, if it's showing twice, I'll buy tickets to both screenings.
Yeah, yeah. Well, part of it is the fun of going to something like that and knowing that behind the scenes there's all these people running around panicked trying to make it work. You know, it's almost like you kind of want it to break down, so they'll run the breakdown reel, which has happened before.
Yeah.
It happened in Bradford this last year, and it was just, it was so much more meaningful when it happened.
Yeah.
Because now you're experiencing that extra rare moment that very few people experienced back in the 50s or whatever.
Yeah.
So
if it if the film, if you don't have the good luck of having the film break, are you just going to run the breakdown reels as a special
program
or something?
They'll run them afterwards, I believe. I think they're scheduled to run afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. And Windjammer has a breakdown reel as well.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's not Lowell Thomas talking. It's they say we're going to change course for a moment here while we're fixing something, you know.
Yeah.
And we're going to show you some, and that's where some of those movies that they shot do appear. That's that regular 35mm that this guy was shooting for the prologue. Some of that appears in this breakdown.
Oh.
Reel, you know. And it's narrated, and Sven Erik, the cadet, is playing the piano in the background. And,
nice.
You know. It's real basic stuff, though. You know. If you didn't know what it was, you'd say, why am I watching this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we will know what we're watching.
Yeah.
So, Dave Strohmeyer, thank you very much. I really appreciate your doing this, and we'll see you at the Dome next week.
Alrighty.
I hope you enjoyed that talk with Dave Strohmeyer, and I hope it's inspired you to go see some of these Cinerama films if you're in the area. And heck, if you're not in the area, catch a plane. You can travel all over the place these days. It's a modern age we live in. So come on, you owe it to yourself. How the West Was Won. How could you not want to come see this? It's great. Henry Fonda is in it. Jimmy Stewart's in it. Carol Baker's in it. Hubba Hubba. It's a terrific movie. And it's bigger than anything you've ever seen in a movie theater. I guarantee you. IMAX, don't even make me laugh. No, Cinerama's the real thing. I'll post the website for the Arclight or the Cinerama Dome on the Commentary Track website, where you can also get Amazon links to a lot of the films that are available in Smilebox. And there aren't that many right now, but the number is growing. I'll put in some links to some other things related to Cinerama that might help educate you if you don't know much about the process. So I'm really excited about this, as you can tell, and I hope that I will see you all at the Dome in the next couple of weeks. I want to thank my wife, Claire, also my co-star in the picture. I think we'll be the new it couple of the movies after you see our backs walking away from the camera for 4 seconds. I want to thank her for being my announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and also my personal website, frankthompson.tv, which is going up this week. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for my wonderful theme music, as always. And just want to thank you, the listener, for going to iTunes and putting a 5-star rating up for the commentary track and leaving a nice review and enticing other people to come listen, because the more people we can get to listen to this, the more assured I can just keep doing it. I've put in, as I said, Amazon links to not only all of my books and the videos that I've been related to, but every guest of the commentary track has his or her own page on the website, with Amazon links to books and videos and other things that they might be connected with. And I hope that you will be inspired to buy some of those things, because when you do and you click through the Commentary Track website to Amazon, then I get a few cents back from Amazon, and that's a nice thing, especially if you do a whole lot of it. Thanks a lot for listening. My guest next week will be the great actor and film historian Jim Beaver, also a swell guy, and I had a really good time interviewing him. So that's coming up next week, and I hope you'll join me again on the commentary track. In the meantime, don't worry, we'll fix it in post.